Hello, everybody. Hello, masters of your own destiny. What's going on? Welcome back to my basement. Yes, you are in the right place. I'm Francisco Suarez, and this is From Suarez Basement, a podcast that we create especially for everybody that is, like me, in love with everything to do with visual storytelling. Those experts working behind some of your favorite TV shows and films, Broadway show plays, those artists that are creating beautiful art through music and painting and sculptors, you name it, we have it here in the basement. Thank you so much again for tuning in. And our guest today, talking about experts, is a fantastic actor who created one of my most favorite characters in the show King Convenia. Paul Sung-hyun Lee is in the house. He played the role of Appa, of course, in the show King Convenient, but he also is now well known for his role of Uncle Iroh in the new adaptation of Avatar: The Last Airbender in Netflix. So I cannot wait to have this conversation with Paul. Thank you so much again to WCNY and PBS in Central New York and Central New York Art for their partnership. It's thanks to these two amazing nonprofit organizations that we can come to you every other week. So WCNY, PBS in Central New York and Central New York Art, thank you so much for the trust and for allowing us to produce this amazing podcast that we put for you every other week. Remember, fsbasement.com is our place. You go there, you're going to be able to see all the past episodes in audio and in video. And you can follow us in all social media, from TikTok and Instagram, Facebook, you name it. We are everywhere. Just click, that you like and become part of our family. fsbasement.com and social media, the way to interact with us. Let's start this new episode from Suarez Basement right away. Here we go. From basement to basement, well, we want to welcome you and thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Oh, well, thank you so much for inviting me. It's an honor.
No, it's a pleasure. Listen, I mean, to be that I'm a big fan of yours is an understatement, because I am. The first time that I discovered you, you will be surprised. You will be like, seriously, we're going to go with King Convenient. But, you know, I think King Convenient is one of those treasures in the stream. You know, I don't know how I even found King Convenient, because it's an old show. We're going to talk about a little bit about it, of course. I think the writing is fantastic. It's funny. It's human. How King Convenient came to you?
Well, you know, thank you, first of all, for that love for Kim's Convenience. And it's not that old, actually. Kim's actually premiered as a television show in 2016. So I guess, oh my God, that's 10 years ago almost.
Right.
So I guess it is almost kind of that old. but I got involved with Kim's Convenience much earlier than that. A lot of people don't realize this, but Kim's Convenience actually started off as a stage play. And in 2005, Ince Choi, who was the writer of the play, he had participated in a playwriting workshop at Fujian Theater Company. And Kim started off as two scenes. That's it. And the two scenes, there was a public reading for the scenes because it was a whole group of playwrights. They presented his two scenes, and it went over so well that Nina Lee Aquino, who was then the artistic director for Fujian Theater Company, encouraged Ince to turn it into a full-length play. And that's when I became involved. Ince was looking for an older Korean actor to read for the part of Appa. And so I sort of joined on then. I've done Ince over the next 5 years on and off, would work on the play, do different iterations of it. He would get enough money to get a workshop together. Actors would get together. We would read out loud. We'd ask him questions. We'd make recommendations and whatnot. He'd go off, do some more rewriting. And then we would do a public reading. And every time we did a public reading, the response was fantastic. And so fast forward to 2011, Ince had finished writing the play. He shopped the play around to every single major theater company in Toronto. And they all said no. Nobody wanted to pick up Kim's Convenience. So he had been working on it for so long. He was determined to see it up on its feet at least once in front of an audience. And so we entered into the Toronto Fringe Festival in 2011. And that's when we had, you know, Kim's had its first premiere in front of a live audience. And we sold the joint out. We became one of the smash hits of the Fringe Festival that year. By the second day, every single advance ticket was sold out. So the only way you could get a ticket is if you lined up for hours in advance. The show won Pick of the Fringe, Best of Fringe Festival. The next stage where they took the best fringe shows and they remounted them the following week at the North York Performing Arts Center. And then all the theater companies that had turned their noses up at the show suddenly came knocking on the door saying, we would love to present Kim's Convenience on our stages. And Ince ended up choosing to go with Soulpepper Theater Company because he was a graduate of their academy program there. He knew the facilities there. He knew the people. He knew that they would nurture and grow the show from, you know, a fringe type show where we were just donating our time and it was bare bones to full fledged production. And Soulpepper, they helped grow the show. And we premiered on their stages in 2012, the spring of 2012. And we smashed all their box office records there too. And it was a bona fide hit. And then after that, we went on a national tour across Canada. And I remember we were in Ottawa at the National Arts Centre when we got word that the show had been picked up and was going to be developed for a television series.
Wow.
And yeah, so it was 2014. We're at the NEC. And we went to camera in 2015. The show premiered in 2016 and we never looked back. And it's because of Kim's Convenience. I love that people still recognize me from Kim's Convenience because that was a launching pad really for my career. I had been working as a journeyman actor since 1999. Oh my God. And really it wasn't until Kim's Convenience that my career took off. Kim's Convenience got me in front of the producers for Star Wars, Dave Filoni. His wife made him watch Kim's Convenience. And it's because of Kim's that he saw my work and liked my work and wanted to write a part for me in The Mandalorian. And, you know, it's because of Kim's Convenience that fan casted me when they found out that they were going to be doing a live action adaptation of Avatar The Last Airbender. So all things sprung from mm-hmm. Kim's Convenience. Mm-hmm. And so I love doing Kim's Convenience. I love, he's still one of my favorite characters of all time. So I will never, ever take umbrage to anybody saying, I'm sorry, but I know you from Kim's Convenience. That's fine.
That is fine. Well, yeah. It is fine. I'm just very, you know, I have the chance through the podcast to interview a lot of actors, which I'm fascinated with the process. There is something about the true person, in this case, Paul, and the true character. Right? And mm-hmm. in order to create good acting, you merge those two things. So mm-hmm. my question to you is, what is of you, Paul, in Appa, and what is Appa in you?
Well, I mean, the character of Appa is when I first read for him, it was the first time I ever got a sense of, I know this guy. I know who this guy is. I know where he comes from. I know what motivates him. I know his thought processes, because I grew up around stubborn, pig-headed men like him, whose heart is in the right place, but whose brain sometimes doesn't follow along. And that's the thing. It is Mr. Kim Appa is an amalgam of all the crazy, stubborn Korean men I grew up with and loved, from my dad to my uncles to my grandfathers, to all the ajashis and the elders at the churches that my parents dragged me to. He's that guy. He's that guy. It's his way or the highway. He knows better than everybody else. He's smarter than everybody else. Right. And so that's the kind of guy. And funny story about Kim's Convenience. I use an accent for the show and that voice is my dad's voice. Hmm. And for the longest time, you know, as a professional Asian actor or an actor, not an Asian, professional Asian, as a professional actor of Asian descent is what I should be saying. At the beginning of my career, oftentimes I was asked to employ an accent. And I could do Chinese, I could do Japanese, I could do different ones. I could not do Korean. There was a block, there was a mental block. I could not do a Korean accent to save my life. It would come out and it would sound Russian. Mm-hmm. Because I had a block, because growing up, I didn't want to be Korean. My parents immigrated to Canada when I was 3 months old. And they were always at work. And so I learned to speak English by watching television, basically. And going to school, it was painfully obvious. I was very different from everybody else, from the food I brought to the way I was dressed, the way I looked, all those things just pointed out I am different. And when you were consuming television like I was back then, and you know, you're watching portrayals of normal, fun families, and you don't see anybody that looks like your family. The ones that you do see are weird and strange, and they're being made fun of. You don't want to be like that, because you are taught that your stories don't matter, that your family is weird, that everybody's going to make fun of you. So who would want to be part of that? And so there was a concerted effort on my part growing up to just want to fit in. I didn't want to be Korean. I just want to be like everybody else. Same food, same way everybody dresses, watch the same shows. You know, my parents, I could do nothing about, because my parents were never, ever like any of my white friends' parents. And, you know, that takes a toll. And I pushed everything away. And I think to this day, I regret it. I deeply, deeply regret those choices, because the irony of all ironies, the biggest sort of boon to my career has been when I've embraced or leaned into what my heritage is. I can't escape that. I'm Korean Canadian. That's who my parents are. That's my heritage. And to spend the majority of my life, formative years, pushing that away, I missed out on language. I missed out on cultural things, so many things. And they're really, really starting to, the consequences of pushing those away, I'm feeling now. I don't speak Korean well enough to communicate with my family, my parents especially. And they're losing their ability to speak English as they get older. They're learning, their English is getting worse, which is really weird. And so it's hard for me to communicate with them, and it's frustrating. And there's a wealth of knowledge that I'm not going to be able to access because I can't talk to my parents, let alone all the culture that I missed, really, by trying to run away from it. And so for me, reading the part of Appa and seeing who he was and seeing so much of my father and all these men that I loved growing up, seeing that reflected in such a loving and respectful manner was just, it was intoxicating, because I'd never, ever seen such a fair depiction of these men before. They're always, you see the stereotypical Asian man on TV who's the angry taskmaster, who is completely unreasonable and is just mean. And that is not these men at all. And, you know, to be able to see like a love letter to my dad melted my heart. And so it was something about that, reading that, that suddenly a lock was opened in my head and my dad's voice started coming out. And so that's the voice I use, is my Appa's voice. And it's really opened up so many doors for me, you know, and that's the way my dad talks. And I know there was a thing earlier on with Kim's, there was a lot of pushback from the Asian community, but mostly from people who had a lot of unpacked baggage and past trauma about their fathers or the men in their lives growing up. And so there was like this huge pushback. But really what it was, Kim's Convenience, is about family. It's about a man and his wife who are trying their best to run a business and raise a family. And the problems that they have, and they're depicted in such a loving human way. And yes, it's a sitcom, so certain elements are going to be exaggerated. But I'd never, ever seen a portrayal as loving as that before.
Well, I think in your case, and again, this is the beauty of this show, is that it is a sitcom. It is funny, but it's incredibly deep and human. And that is what it makes it, that half an hour go so fast. And I want to watch the next one, is because you feel so connected to these characters. And, you know, yes, you represent the Asian community, but the truth is that you represent a lot of more than just that. I'm saying, I don't need to be Asian, I'm a Latino, but I see myself identify so much even in Appa, because my father is not that much different of Appa. You know? He knows everything, he's right always, but he has a huge heart. But that's who he is. Yeah. Right? And it's that generation too. I think it's a generational thing, where men need to be men and men know what they're doing.
Yeah. And that's the universality of it. You know, and you hit it right on the head. Specifically, it's very Korean, but in that way, it's very universal, because it is about relationships, fathers and sons and wives and husbands and daughters and fathers and whatnot. It is like the family dynamic still remains the same. It is about a group of people who love each other, but do not necessarily know how to express that love in a way that the other person fully understands. And, you know, that's what's so recognizable about it. And what I love about it as well is because it makes this type of family, an Asian family, so normal in that sense, because you look at it and you go, oh my God, that's just like my dad. He's not Korean. This is a dad thing. This is, like you say, it's a generational thing. This is how men of this generation believe that they need to act. Right. And so this is, and that's a gift as an actor to be able to play that. And, you know, what I loved about the Kim's family, it was like they weren't hyper idealized. It wasn't like, you know, they had faults. They were petty. There were consequences for their actions. But at the core of it, they had really good hearts. And there were hard lessons to be learned sometimes. But at the same time, too, it was never this super, you know, like model minority type family. Mm-hmm. You know, they had warts and all. And that's what they made them a human family. And I really, really, for the first time ever, to be able to play a character like that in a leading role was just a dream come true.
And Paul, we cannot talk about your career as an actor without talking, of course, of your participation in Star Wars, which is fascinating. I can't imagine. I mean, I grew up in the 70s. Actually, I was born in the 70s. So for me, Star Wars is the ultimate goal of everything, yeah. Right? Going to the theaters to see Star Wars changed my life in so much as how I decide to pursue my career in visual storytelling. I am working in television, and now I'm a professor who teach video production and video production and visual storytelling and script writing, because I love it. That's in my gene. But Star Wars is in that level where, my God, it changed everything. Do you get a call from whom? How this happened? How excited were you in this?
I was working, you know, oh my God, how to explain this? I was invited in 2018 to the Unforgettable Gala in Los Angeles. And the Unforgettable Gala really is kind of like a celebration of all the Asian American artists in the media. Okay. And, you know, like affectionately known as Asian Prom, basically. Okay. And I got invited there because of Kim's Convenience. And I'd never been to LA before for any length of time. It would have been my first time. I didn't really want to go. And so I said, well, I'll only go if the rest of the cast gets to come. And so Yvonne Fetson, who's a producer for Kim's Convenience, said, yeah, absolutely, it's a great idea. So he, you know, they pony up the money for the cast to go to Los Angeles. We're there. And, you know, you're in Hollywood. It's like Tinseltown and all the stars are there. And we're at this gala and this woman jumps in front of me and I haven't seen her in 25 years. And she said, Paul, do you remember me? So that woman was Deborah Chow. Deborah Chow, some of the Star Wars fans might recognize, she was a director during season one of The Mandalorian, did a couple of really great episodes there. She was then tasked to help write and direct and produce the Obi-Wan Kenobi series that happened afterwards. Now, Deb and I, what a lot of people don't know is Deborah's from Toronto. And we'd actually worked together 25 years ago at the Factory Theater in Toronto. She was working in the administrative offices there, and I was there on a government grant to learn about arts admin. And so that's how I met Deb. And what ended up happening was she was an aspiring filmmaker. I was an aspiring actor. She asked me if I'd be willing to be in a short film that she was making. I said yes. We shot the film, and then she disappeared. She literally just disappeared, and I didn't see her until she jumped in front of me again in Los Angeles. I said, Deb, what are you doing here? So that short film got her into Columbia Film School. She became a director, tried to get work in Canada, couldn't, went down to the States, started working as a director in the States. And she said, I'm in Los Angeles because I'm working on The Mandalorian. And I was like, oh my God. So you've heard of it. Said, are you kidding me? Yes. The first live action Star Wars TV show. Like this is insane. You're working on it? She said, yeah, I've been trying to get in touch with you because Dave Filoni is a fan of your work. And he wants to write something for you. And like, I almost passed out, right? Like everything got all hazy. I was like, oh my God, you're kidding, right? Because I love Star Wars as much as you love Star Wars. Right. And so this was incredible. I said, you know, I grabbed her arm and I said, hey, look, you do realize I have like 8 or 9 cosplays of Star Wars uniforms. I'm a member of the 501st Canadian Garrison, which is the cosplaying charity group for Star Wars. I have screen accurate costumes. Oh, she says, no. I said, yes. And she said, send me pictures. I'll send them to Dave. So I did. And so Dave was like, oh my God, this is great. He could just show up to set in his costumes. they invited me to do a set visit. So 2 weeks later, I flew back to Los Angeles. I went, I visited the set. I got to watch Deborah work, direct a scene. I got to watch Dave direct a scene. I met Jon Favreau. I got a tour of the props department, the wardrobe department, had dinner with Dave. It's just like, you know, I died. Wow. It was just a dream come true for a Star Wars fan to be able to watch them make, you know, the first season of Mandalorian. 6 months later, I'm still floating on cloud nine. I get a call from my agent saying, hey, so Lucasfilm called and they want to know your availability. And I was like, oh my God, this can only mean one thing. And so it was like, yeah, they offered me a part. I didn't have to audition for it. Wow. They offered me a part. It was for Foodie Pilot number one.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, what the hell does that mean? Is he like some kind of a catering truck driver or like something like that? They use code words for all the characters. So Foodie Truck Driver was just a code word, code mm-hmm. name. And I thought, oh, okay, sure. And I thought I was going to be under all this latex or prosthetics. No one was going to really see my face, but that's okay because I'll be in Star Wars.
Right.
And then I found out, no, it's a face character. We're going to see your face and you're going to be an X-Wing pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, how many times did I cry? I cried so many times.
It was
ridiculous, you know?
I'm sure.
That's wow. a dream come true. Yeah, and so...
What a beautiful story, by the way.
Yeah.
So your newest character is Uncle Iroh in Avatar in Netflix.
Yeah.
And I just... Well, first, I'm in love with the show itself just because production value is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And the story, I think, you know, these type of stories, sad enough, I feel like are so relating in these days.
Right.
You know, this idea of bad and evil and who want to control what. And, you know, I think we need an avatar.
Right. To bring balance.
To
yeah,
bring
100%.
Balance to the universe. The question is, who will be that avatar, right?
Yeah, no, this might be the 100-year period where the avatar is frozen in ice.
I think so. I think that's what is happening. Well, let's not get negative. Let's think about the positive. So in this story, you play a character that is very interesting because Uncle Iroh is this character that, let's say, is related to the bad guys. Is the brother of. However, he's still being a very likable character. How do you explain that contraposition between the fact that he is working for the bad guys, but at the same time, he seems to be having a very, very kind heart?
Yeah, it's interesting just because, you know, like you say, we don't want to get too bogged down in the negative because ultimately Avatar is about hope. Mm-hmm. That's what the series is about. It's about hope during our darkest times. And I think some of the complexities that we've brought that really do carry over from the cartoon series too. I mean, I find it so ridiculous that people are so dismissive of anything animated because they automatically think, well, it's for children. So it's got to be very simple and childlike and whatnot. Some of the most complex themes and ideas and issues are tackled through animation. And, you know, you're doing yourself a disservice if you're just going to write something off because it's animated. First and foremost, that's what I'm going to say. There is a certain complexity that is brought over because we did use the cartoon series as a base for us. Mm-hmm. That was our ground zero. That's how we built everything from. The adaptation is of itself completely its own thing, though, right? And so what we've been able to do is stay faithful to a certain extent to the source material, but we are creating our own show. And in this show, there is a complexity of character. Things in life are never black and white. They're never that simple. Mm. And so this is carried on to all the characters. Iroh has this word, this line, I think in episode 4, he says, you know, cities are like people. They all have their dark places, right? And it's true. None of us is perfect. None of us is perfect. And if we can agree that even the best of us can have their dark parts, we can also agree then the worst of us can have their good parts. Not to say that Iroh is like that, but there is that complexity in life, the gray areas that I think the show touches upon, where you can be part of the Fire Nation, the aggressors in this 100-year war for domination. But to the Fire Nation, the idea is this is the only way the world can be at peace, is under their control. They're the most powerful. They're the only ones. I'm not saying it's right, but that is the mentality. Very few times do the bad guys think they're the bad guys. They don't go, we are the bad guys, so we're going to do bad things. No bad guy in the history of bad guys has ever thought that. So that sort of carries on. And there's a sadness to Iroh because he was on that track of he was next in line to be the Fire Lord. He was the dreaded Dragon of the West, the general that laid siege to Ba Sing Se for 600 days, a cunning warrior, ruthless enemy. And he gave that all up. Mm. He gave it all up. Now, he was usurped in his path to the crown by his younger brother, right? Unbeknownst to him. But it was really until after he suffered the loss of one of the things he loved the most in his life, which was his son, Lu Ten, during the siege of Ba Sing Se, that really for him, life came. He lost everything that was important. And so his perspective changed. And he saw that his track was empty and there was nothing to it and fruitless and how much damage he was doing. And so now he is on a more enlightened path. And he's very, very surreptitiously moving against. He doesn't believe in what the Fire Nation is doing anymore. Not really overtly speaking out against it either, because he knows that's suicide. So he's playing the system the best way he knows how. And in this iteration too, he sees kindness and compassion in Crown Prince Zuko, who should be the next in line for the Fire Throne. Mm. And so he is there. He has a debt of gratitude to Zuko, a love for Zuko that has been missing since the passing of his son. And so he's using Zuko as a sort of a surrogate, but also as a means to perhaps change the trajectory of the Fire Nation and to give him life lessons and to spare him the pain that Zuko is feeling right now. And that is one of, a traumatized youth who is being used by his father and abused in that sense to these nefarious ends. And so it's fascinating playing a character like this because, yeah, he's done some awful things. Iroh, but he's trying to atone for them.
Paul, and listen, I'm in awe that I can have this conversation with you because I'm a big fan of your work. I always say to my guests that because I love what I do so much, I could be here the entire day talking to you about many things. but that doesn't mean that I wouldn't like to close a little bit with two things. One is for the upcoming new generation of actors, visual storytellers, writers, in your own experience, what is something that you would like to tell them that you think will help them to navigate a very difficult area, which is the entertainment industry? So what would be that?
It's the road that you are taking is a hard one. It's not for the faint of heart. That's not to say that it's an impossible journey. But it will be fraught, as are many other journeys, with a lot of pitfalls, a lot of setbacks. But at the end of the day, if it is something that you are truly passionate about, keep at it. Surround yourself with peers and friends who are like-minded, who will support you. Always do the work. Learn at every opportunity. Learn, learn, learn. Treat your profession as a profession. It's not a hobby. This is something that deserves the respect, even though it might not get the respect of people outside who don't understand necessarily what you are doing, but treat your journey with the respect and the professionalism it deserves. And above all else, be kind. Mm-hmm. Be kind. Be kind to yourself. Be kind to others. You don't know what they're going through. They don't know what you're going through. But at the end of the day, there's always, always, always room for kindness. It might be the most difficult thing in the world to do, but you will be better off because of that. And it is. I've always said I've succeeded because I'm just too stupid and too stubborn to quit. So if I can do it, all of you can do it. So well, good luck. And thank you so honestly, much. Yeah.
I mean, listen, you fill my heart with hope and care and love. And I just wish you of course, all the best, which I think is going to be. Send you all good fire energy through the wave. and good luck with all your upcoming projects. And I will see you in Avatar every time I watch.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to meet you. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.